The following message was given by Garnerton Armstrong in the fall of 1957.
All right, I want to turn over to another section. The Secret History of Nazism and so on. Then it mentions a diary from a German officer. I won't bother to read that part. Here's a sector from the policy of genocide and how they were going to exterminate the entire Jewish race, if they possibly could. Let's see. It began here. About 80,000 German or Russian war prisoners were executed and buried near the village of Glinskin in 34 grave pits in the Blagoshina forest near Minsk. The Nazis buried 150,000 people, enough to populate a good-sized city. 10,000 in a ditch near Drozdy, 254 children in a ditch near Kerch. When the bodies were exhumed from these mass graves, Soviet medical experts established that many of the victims had been buried alive. Large numbers of the bodies were dreadfully mutilated and bore evidence of fearful tortures inflicted by the Nazis. Frequently, the bodies of fathers and mothers were found with their dead children and infants still clutched in their arms. Here's a footnote. The famous Soviet novelist and journalist Ilya Ehrenberg wrote, "The word ravine used to be a good word. It spoke of grass, rivulet, sand, and the big-eyed daisies where children used to pull apart murmuring, 'He loves me, he loves me not.' But the word ravine has become a terrible word. One feels that at any moment the dead will come stalking out of a ravine. And not only out of the ravine in Tripoli, for there is a ravine in Kiev, too. Every Ukrainian town has its ravine, and everywhere it's the same story. Patches of underlinen, rigid corpses, children's toys sprinkled with blood." Scenes of unspeakable horror took place during the mass executions of Soviet men, women, and children. Here's one of them described by Alexander Bebspolov to the Soviet authorities. He saw the following in June 1943. "At the end of June last year, I myself saw as many as 300 girls and women brought to the woods in 10 or 12 motor trucks. These poor people ran hither and thither, weeping, tearing their hair and clothes, many of them dropping in a swoon. But the German fascists paid no attention to this. They punched them and beat them with their rifle butts and clubs to make them get up. If they did not get up, the butchers tore their clothes off and threw them into the pit. Several girls and children tried to run away but were killed. After a round was fired from automatic rifles, I saw several women stagger and throw their arms helplessly and, uttering heart-rending shrieks, run toward the Germans standing about, begging them, 'Don't kill me.' The Germans shot them down with pistols. Mothers, driven out of their minds by fear and grief, ran shrieking about the glade, pressing their babies to their breasts, seeking safety. The Gestapo men tore the children out of their mothers' arms and, swinging them by their arms or legs, threw them alive into the pit. As the mothers ran after them, they were shot down. Wholesale execution," said Corporal Reinhard Retzlaff of the German secret field police, "by hanging and shooting appeared to be the German command to be too bothersome and slow a means of fulfilling the task set by the punitive organizations, and it was therefore deemed necessary to devise simpler means of exterminating the population. And it must be said that these means were found, which was by gas and mass live burials." Retzlaff went on to relate how in 42 he had seen a large, gray, strange-looking automobile standing near the entrance of one of the Gestapo prisons in Kharkov and surrounded by a group of German policemen. His curiosity aroused, he asked a police official he knew named Kaminsky what sort of an automobile it was. He told him that it was a gas van, that it was used for putting people to death. Later he said, "I had numerous opportunities of seeing this automobile at work, and on several occasions I took a direct part in loading it with prisoners confined in the Kharkov prison. On these occasions I was able to convince myself that the gas van fully answered its purpose. This was to speed up the process of exterminating the Soviet citizens. Large covered automobiles, the interior lined with zinc-plated sheet iron. In the rear they had double doors that could be sealed. The floor had a grating beneath which there was a pipe connecting it with the exhaust pipe of the engine. When the motors were running, the waste gas from a diesel engine poured through a grating in the floor and they were asphyxiated from carbon monoxide fumes. Thousands of them died in these Nazi death vans. The factories of death, the German prison camps where United States citizens are going to be confined. Mass executions at Maidenach began in the winter of 1941 and lasted all through the war until 1945. At first, shooting was the usual method of execution. Out of a party of 2,000 Soviet war prisoners brought to the camp, only 80 remained alive after a few days. The remainder had been shot. Early in 1942, 6,000 men, women, and children were shot within the course of 2 days. On another occasion, in a single day, 88 truckloads of civilian prisoners were driven to the Krempek forest, which stood near the camp. They were shot and their bodies thrown into huge pits. The greatest of the mass executions began or occurred on November 3, 1943. On that single day, 18,400 prisoners from all over Europe were shot on the prison grounds and their bodies buried in tremendous ditches. He mentioned how they had to install loudspeakers and played music to drown out the shrieks of the people all during the day. SS troopers, quote, from what a German said to them, brought out the people, stripped naked in groups of 50 to 100 to the pits, laid them on the bottom of the pits face downwards and shot them from Tommy guns. Another group of live people was then laid upon their dead bodies and shot in the same manner and so on until the pits were filled. Then the bodies were covered with a thin layer of earth and 2 or 3 days later removed and buried in the crematorium or on the bonfires. Then a poison cell, gas cells, annihilation of 18,000 here, 20,000 there, 30,000 here. I won't read any more of that section. There's an entire chapter on it. One or two more excerpts. Here's one. God prophesies, brethren, that this is going to happen to the United States. It has happened in the past. He prophesies that this is the exact manner in which babies are to be killed in this country. A former prisoner named Atrokov told a Polish Soviet Atrocities Commission they took a baby from its mother's breast and killed it before her eyes by smashing it against the barracks wall. I myself, said Edward Barron, another witness, saw how babies were taken from their mothers and killed before their eyes. They would take a baby by one foot and step on the other and so tear the baby apart. Brutality. Yes, it's terrible. If you have children, you know how you feel when you hear of things like this. I have three and I know how it makes me feel. But it is going to happen here. It is going to happen here. That is as sure a fact as the fact that you're sitting here. Anyone who doesn't believe it, all I have to say is, wait and see. And God grant that when it does happen, if any of you are there, you'll remember the things you heard. And remain steadfast even through torture if you have to, knowing that there's only one possible way you can be saved and get protection finally. All right? Let's go now to chapter 2. How has the Lord covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud in his anger and cast down from heaven unto the earth the beauty of Israel and remembered not his footstool in the day of his anger? The Lord has swallowed up all the habitations of Jacob and has not pitied. Can you imagine what it is going to be like for people who are so concerned with little, physical, unimportant, unnecessary, minute points today? And who are not concerned about getting close to God and obeying God. Can you imagine the thought in their mind as they stand in the forest glade with Nazi machine gunners facing them? And what they would give if just one soldier would smile at them and say, not you, we'll spare you. We won't shoot you today. We'll let you go free. How much wealth would they fork over? How many Cadillacs would they give? You think they would give something more, dear? Yes, I dare say they would say, please amputate both my legs, but don't kill me. Take my arm, if you will, but don't kill me. But they won't be given the chance because there will be no mercy. God is going to forsake this nation totally. They'll cry out to God. They'll say, God, save us! And God will not hear. He will close his ears to it. That's what he says. Yes, they'll scream and beg for mercy, but there will be none. No mercy shown. He has brought them down to the ground and has polluted the kingdom and the princes thereof. He has cut off in his fierce anger all the horn of Israel. He has drawn back his right hand from before the enemy. Only God has withheld them. And he burned against Jacob like a flaming fire which devours round about. Notice verse 5, the Lord was an enemy. He has swallowed up Israel. He has swallowed up all her palaces. He has destroyed his strongholds. San Diego was one of his strongholds. We have a lot of Navy and military bases around here. And has increased in the daughter of Judah mourning and lamentation. Notice verse 9. Her gates are sunk into the ground. He has destroyed and broken her bars. Her king and her princes are among the Gentiles, scattered among the nations, where the law is not. Her prophets also find no vision from the Eternal. The elders of the daughter of Zion sit upon the ground and keep silence. The elderly people who feel they should be given deference will be shown no mercy. They're not physically strong enough to work, so you know what the Nazis did? They killed them first. The young women were fit for the labor camps and the German soldiers, so they would preserve them alive if they felt it was necessary only for a period of time. The young men could work in slave and prison camps, the ones they needed, the others they shot. The elderly people were a burden on the new state, the new order, and so they were shot. The little children, they were a nuisance. They always cried and got in the way. They were frightened when they saw their parents being beaten. The German officers didn't like to hear them cry, so they were shot. The elders of the daughter of Zion sit upon the ground and keep silence. They have cast up dust upon their heads. They have girded themselves with sackcloth. The virgins of Jerusalem hang down their hands to the ground, their heads to the ground. Mine eyes do fail with tears. My bowels are troubled. My liver is poured upon the earth for the destruction of the daughter of my people. Because the children and the sucklings swoon in the streets of the city. Little babies sitting out in the midst of the devastation, fainting from hunger and thirst and dying. They say to their mothers, where is the corn and wine? Where is food? When they swooned as the wounded in the streets of the city, when their soul was poured out into their mother's bosom, bleeding to death right in their mother's arms. What thing shall I take to witness for you? What thing shall I liken unto you, O daughter of Jerusalem? What shall I equal to you that I may comfort you, O virgin daughter of Zion? For your breach is great like the sea. You've broken away from me so far it's as wide as the ocean, he says. Who can heal you? Your prophets, not mine, but yours. Yours of this nation, your ministers, your preachers. Your churches have seen vain and foolish things for you. And they have not discovered your iniquity. What did Alan Manteuffel just tell you? Isaiah 58:1, God says, cry aloud and spare not and show my people their sins. But they have heaped to themselves teachers having itching ears. They say, don't prophesy the truth. Speak smooth things and deceits. Tell us there is going to be no war with Germany. Tell us we're going to have utopia in 1976. Tell us we're just now entering the jet in the atomic age when we're going to have push-button living. Tell us everything is going to be all right. Don't tell us the truth. They have not discovered your iniquity to turn away your captivity, but have seen for you false burdens. The burden of the prophet, the message that he has given, in other words, they have seen false messages and things to draw you aside. All that pass by, notice this, all the foreign nations who see this occur to us before 1980, and I say not maybe, but positively, definitely, as God lives, before 1980. And the Bible says the same thing. All that pass by clap their hands at you. They rejoice. They hiss and wag their head at the daughter of Jerusalem, saying, is this the city that men call the perfection of beauty? Is this that great land, the United States of America? Is this that great country that we feared all these years? Is this the way their citizens look, being dragged by the heels, head down, a beaten mass through our capital cities? We're a healthy nation, aren't we? You want a cross-section? Go to the Greyhound Bus Depot and look at 50 people who walk by. That's a cross-section of the entire nation. Are we deceiving ourselves? Do we think we're healthy? Do we think we're a nation of 6'6" men with brawny arms and strong backs, armed to the teeth and ready to go out and conquer, to carry the white man's burden stomping through any country on the face of the earth? Is our Marines, our gallant Marine Corps, are they going to save us? Take a look at them. A bunch of shaved-head juvenile delinquents, to put it plainly, on the majority, on the whole, who don't know which end is up, who know less about geography, world conditions, politics and world relations and the Bible and anything in general for that matter, than a nincompoop. I was in the Navy for 4 years. Mr. Hill has been in the Navy most of his life. He can tell you the same thing. I wouldn't have given you that for the entire might of the 7th Fleet out there off Korea during the Korean War. If the Russians had chosen to blast those two carriers to the bottom of the sea, they could have done it with one plane, one aircraft. We floated out there like a bunch of fools while a Russian submarine surfaced in the middle of the convoy and followed us for an entire night. And we didn't do a thing. The equipment was shabby, outdated, it didn't work. The repairmen were constantly working on the 40-millimeter guns. They never worked and functioned. The gunners rarely could hit the broadside of a barn. The only way they could hit a thing was when the plane that was towing the sleeve happened to be going at an extreme slow rate of speed. But you know, we're not shooting at old outdated Grumman Avengers anymore, but at MIG jets. They go a little faster nowadays. In fact, up to 1,000 miles an hour. Not down at 98 miles an hour, with flaps down and going slow enough so our gunners can shoot. Who are we trusting in, anyhow? I was on that ship. I know that that is the most stupidly run organization of non-militaristic policies, of disobedience to superior officers, of neglect and gold-bricking, and getting off of the duty any possible time they can, going to sick call at the slightest excuse, of getting out of every duty they possibly can, of any army on the face of this earth. The Egyptians could whip them. Matched man for man. But our resources and our ingenuity and God's miracles have stood us in good stead up until 1951. And that's when, as Mr. Hay explained in his article about Leviticus 26, that things began to turn. That was the turning point. Look at Korea. What happened there? Just look. This great, tremendous country with all of its strength. Look how big we are on the map, and then look at how small Korea is. We evacuated the Changjin Reservoir. We were pushed clear back down. All we had was Pusan, clear down on the end of the tip of Korea. Just a little foothold. That's all. Until finally we mustered enough strength to start pushing them back, and we had to pour thousands upon thousands of men and supplies in there, and trucks and tanks, before we finally managed to push them back toward the 38-degree parallel. And that's where it remains today. We demanded that they do thus and such. They have broken every single provision of that armistice or treaty. There remains not one single minute point that has not been totally broken. We have not so much as passed them a stinging note on the subject. Oh, we're a great nation. We're really a great, strong, fearful nation. But we're hated, we're despised, we're spit at. A greasy little corporal, when you land at an airport over in the Middle East, as Mr. and Mrs. Armstrong did last summer, if you go through the borders in Europe or down in Central or South America, we'll take your passport and say, Americans, you wait here. And then the Germans go through. And next the Italians. And next the Middle Eastern people. Finally the British. And last of all, after the British, come the Americans. In the order of preference, you see. That's the way it always works. Mr. Ray and I repeatedly were the last. We would be the first out of the plane, the first into the office, the first to sit down, and the last to go through customs. All through Central America, every single city we went into, and in Colombia, in South America. If you don't believe it, go there. People who have been there believe it, and they know. These things are not many years hence. That's what I want you to get today. Just as a matter of rehearsal, and perhaps I could entitle it, quote, "Lest We Forget," unquote. Lest we forget. You know, maybe you could say this, lest we forget that it hurts to die. It doesn't feel good to get chopped into pieces. It's unpleasant to have your children dashed against the curbing in front of your own eyes. And God says these things are going to happen to this country. And he has given God's church, his people, a way to escape. And there is only one way to escape. The Canadian Rockies are not far enough away. You can't run far enough. Punta Arenas, the southernmost city on the face of the earth, they're down at the utmost tip of Chile, on Tierra del Fuego, is not far enough to run. Because they would get you there, too. And if the army doesn't get you, God says the plague will get you. And if the plague doesn't, the drought will. And if the drought doesn't, the famine will. And there is going to be no escape. Every last man, woman, and child is going to have to suffer unless they're under God's protection. All your enemies have opened their mouth against you. They hiss and gnash the teeth. Notice that. All these foreign nations hiss at our state when we're going to be brought totally to our knees, and they gnash their teeth. And they say, "We have swallowed her up. Look how great we are. Certainly this is the day that we looked for. This is the day we have been living for. This is what we have yearned for all of our lives. We wouldn't have believed it is possible. Look at what a tremendous thing has happened. The United States lies a smoking heap of ruin. New York vaporized. Chicago gone. Los Angeles is not. San Diego, a pit of smoking ruin. Nothing left of the major cities. Her eastern nation, cities and the industry smashed. Her citizens in total rout. Unprepared. Totally unprepared. Unhealthy. Frightened nearly to death, out of their wits, to where they will be trampling each other in the streets. We have a civil defense measure up in Los Angeles, a wonderful plan made by our learned city officials, who have a mass exodus plan, so that everyone, the minute we get the warning of an A-bomb on its way, we're given approximately 45 minutes from the time the bomber reaches the tip of Alaska. Between the time it reaches Alaska and the time the bomb falls on Los Angeles is 45 minutes. We're all going to jump in our cars and, in orderly fashion, go out from the city. That's what they said in the Los Angeles Times and gave you diagrams. Where do we enter the freeway? Stupid people. Stupid, ignorant people. Try to drive through Los Angeles at a speed more than 10 miles an hour at 4 o'clock any afternoon and you'll kill yourself. You can't do it. That's just normal work traffic going home after a day's labor. Stupid people. It makes my blood boil. It really does. Now, maybe that's fanatic religious doctrine. And maybe it's common sense. And maybe it's God's truth. All right, let's go on. We found. This is the day we looked for. We have found. We have seen it. Oh, how happy they're going to be. They will actually see us go down. How they're going to dance and sing and rejoice. The Eternal has done that which he had devised. He has fulfilled his word that he had commanded in the days of old. Yes, from way back during the time of King Hezekiah, God proposed this. Jeremiah's prophecy about Israel's captivity was written before. Or I should say after, 120 some years after Israel even went into captivity. And yet he's prophesying about a captivity for Israel. A captivity that has not occurred as yet. He is thrown down and has not pitied. You ask, why would God allow a foreign nation to come in and actually rip up the bellies of pregnant women and saw their babies in half that are yet unborn? Which also has been done, and eyewitness accounts which tell of it. You ask, why would God permit that? Remember the second commandment. For I am the Lord, I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. But we don't hate God, they say. All we do is say we repudiate his law. We will not keep his Sabbath. We don't believe his ministers. We say the sword will not come nigh our dwellings. This country will never fall. The United States will go on to be the greatest nation on the face of the earth in every way, technologically, financially, economically, physically. By 1975, we're all going to be physically much more healthy. We won't even have to heat our food. It will come in preheated little cans or pills or bottles. That's what they say by 1975. By 1975, American people will be blessed. They will feel blessed if they can scrape the smallest bit of a rotten potato peel out of the bottom of a filthy garbage can. Believe it or not. Now notice this. He has caused your enemy to rejoice over you. He has set up the horn of your adversaries. Their heart cried unto the Lord, O well of the daughter of Zion, let tears run down like a river day and night. Give yourself no rest, let not the apple of your eye cease. Arise, cry out in the night. In the beginning of the watches, pour out your heart like water before the face of the Lord. Lift up your hands toward him for the life of your young children that faint for hunger in the top of every street. Behold, O Eternal, and consider to whom you have done this. Shall the women eat their fruit and the children of a span long? Shall the priest and the prophet be slain in the sanctuary of the Lord? The young and the old lie on the ground in the streets. My virgins and my young men are fallen by the sword, and you have slain them in the day of your anger. You have killed and not pitied. You have called, as in a solemn day, my terrors round about, so that in the day of the Lord's anger none escaped nor remained. Those that I have swaddled and brought up has my enemy consumed. Now notice this. Page 136 of this book. The Germans systematically accumulated the clothing and possessions of the men, women, and children who had been killed and stored the articles in enormous warehouses, in dozens of various sized rooms. They were all tagged and shipped in trucks and cars and railroad cars off to Germany to be sold. All right, now let me see. I don't want to read all of this, but just some excerpts to get this point across. When Red Army troops entered the Maidenack camp in 1944, they found 820,000 pair of different kinds of shoes and footwear in one of the camp's warehouses. The shoes and boots had trademarks of firms from Paris, Vienna, Brussels, Warsaw, Trieste, Prague, Riga, Antwerp, Amsterdam, Kiev, Krakow, Lubim, Lvov, and other cities in Russia and Western Europe. Quote, I have been in a wooden warehouse at the camp, wrote the American correspondent Mr. W. H. Lawrence, in which I walked across literally tens of thousands of shoes spread across the floor like grain in a half-filled elevator. Here is how Simonov described the warehouse. It is hard to say how many pairs of shoes there are here. There are so many that they overflow through the windows and the doors. In one place, their weight has broken the wall, and part of the wall has fallen out together with a mountain of shoes. There is footwear of all shades and descriptions. Torn Russian soldiers' boots, Polish army boots, men's shoes, women's slippers, rubber overshoes, and most terrible of all, tens of thousands of children's shoes, sandals, boots, and shoes worn by children of 10, 8, 6, and even the little booties of one-year-old infants. Tens of thousands. It is hard to imagine a more horrifying spectacle than this mute witness to the death of hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children. A mother brings a baby into the earth in the pains of childbirth. She puts it to her breast day after day and night after night. She gets up at 3 o'clock in the morning. She loves it, caresses it, bathes it, takes care of it, works over it, nourishes that child for days. Finally weeks, and then months, and finally years. She teaches it how to say Dada and Mommy. She rears it up under the guidance of her hands and makes it a part of her. For years, until here is a young boy of 6 or 8. For what? To be chopped into by a bayonet from a foreign soldier? To be slaughtered in some ignominious stinking swamp? Shot down brutally, mercilessly? To be dashed against a barracks wall by a brutal soldier laughing at the blood-curdling screams of the youngster? Why were you born? Were you born to face this kind of an end? Is that what human life is for? Or is there a purpose? And is there a reason why we draw breath? Now, God has said there is a way to escape. I'm going to close now quickly by going over to Ezekiel and the 33rd chapter. Verse 1, again the word of the Eternal came to me, saying, Son of man, speak to the children of your people, and say unto them, When I bring the sword upon the land, if the people of the land take a man of their coast, and set him for their watchman, if when he sees the sword come upon the land, He blow the trumpet and warn the people. Then whosoever hears the sound of the trumpet and takes not warning, if the sword come and take him away, his blood shall be upon his own head. He heard the sound of the trumpet and took not warning, his blood shall be upon him. Why is God going to allow these people to suffer merciless deaths? They will not listen. They have heard God's prophet. They have heard the message going on now 23 or 4 years. They will not heed. But a little tiny pitiful handful. Does this sound not quite right when you think of the hundreds of thousands and you compare the size of God's church with them? But then when you look in the Bible and investigate how many God said there would be, it looks exactly right. That the many would be going the way of the easy way of the line of least resistance, the way of the world, the way of stupidity. But the few would be seeking the narrow and the straight way. Few there be that find it, Christ said. If they take not warning, their blood will be on their own heads. But he that takes warning shall deliver his soul. But if the watchman see the sword come and blow not the trumpet, and the people be not warned, if the sword come and take any person from among them, he is taken away in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at the watchman's hand. You are also a part of the watchman. You are a part of the watchman as much as Mr. Armstrong. His is the voice that is being used. Your faith, your prayers, your life has an awful lot to do with it. A great deal. So thou, O son of man, I have set you a watchman under the house of Israel. Therefore you shall hear the word at my mouth and warn them from me. When I say unto the wicked, O wicked man, you shall surely die. If you do not speak to warn the wicked from his way, that wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at your hand. Nevertheless, if you warn the wicked of his way to turn from it, if he do not turn from his way, he shall die in his iniquity nevertheless, you see. But you have delivered your soul. Therefore, O son of man, speak unto the house of Israel. Thus you speak, saying, if our transgressions and our sins be upon us, and we pine away in them, how shall we then live? Say unto them, as I live, saith the Lord eternal, he can swear by nothing higher. I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked. He doesn't derive pleasure from babies having their brains dashed out against the curbstones, but that the wicked turn from his way and live. That's what he wants these foolish people to do. He doesn't have pleasure in their deaths. He doesn't have pleasure in their sufferings, but he wants them to turn away. He says, turn you from your evil ways. For why will you die, O house of Israel? Why will you die? And yet it seems that they want death, doesn't it? It seems that they will not listen. It seems that the louder you shout and the more plain you make it, the more they will rebel and say, well, now I heard another minister that said that we're not going to be taken into a captivity. The test for a prophet is if these things come to pass. For the past 23 years, the prophecies that Mr. Armstrong has been preaching have been happening. I didn't believe it either as a little boy. I grew up fighting that as hard as I could. And I went astray and rebelled and fought and didn't believe and smirked and sneered and spit like all the rest of the carnal-minded idiots who don't have a bit of sense in this world. But now I can see, and I'm thankful I can. Very thankful. And now I can look back, and I remember that while our bombers were busily pounding Germany to rubble, my father had the audacity to say that Germany was going to rise again. And I didn't believe it, and neither did the United States of America. But it has happened. It has happened. Those figures I gave you appeared in the United States News and World Report. Those figures that I gave you about Western Germany appear in your newspapers, not in the Bible, not from something that I got out of my own mind. He said that in 1943. He said it in 1944 and again in 1945 and wrote articles to the subject. Amazing, isn't it? But you see, it's in the Bible. And that's why it is sure, and that's why it is going to happen. And that's why babies are going to die in the streets of the United States of America. Not because we want it to, because we want with all our hearts that it should not happen, just as God also wants it. And he said he is not willing that any should perish, but that all should repent. He takes no pleasure in their death. He wants them to turn from their ways, but they won't. And so he's going to have to punish them. All right, I'm going to leave off there. If any of you care to obtain this book, if you think you can stomach some of these things, and truly it is difficult to read through some of it, I think you could probably get it by writing to the Dial Press in New York and asking for it by name. It's called The Plot Against the Peace, if you want to buy it for your own library or for your own use. There are other sections in it. It is not all just an account of German documents. There are other sections about the plans of the Germans, different Nazi front organizations, different organizations in Central and South America, in Spain and other parts of the world where IG Farben and Krupp Industries, the steel mills and so on, are flourishing right now. And so it would be a valuable asset, I think, if you do care to look over it. And if any of you care to buy it, why, please do. All right, let's have a closing song now. Would you all rise and let's sing the one at the top of page 36, Blessed Be the Tide. We're going to have to get on our way within about 15 minutes now, so I want to go ahead and bring it to a close.
Blessed be the tie that binds our hearts in Christian love. The fellowship of kindred minds is like to have above. Before a Father's Son, before our and prayers, a peace of hopes, our aims are one, our comforts and our cares. We share our mutual woes, our mutual burdens bear, and often for each other close the sympathizing tear. When we asunder part, it gives us inward pain, but we shall still be joined in heart and hope to meet again.
This message is provided by the Bible Study website at address www.biblestudy.org and Barnabas Ministries. Bible Study. You have questions, the Bible has answers. Message introduction and closing by Dave Williams, digitizing and editing by Alan Ruth, and post-production by Mike Summers.